You couldn't even believe Jim Bill Rango when he said hello. Down in that mussel shell country, he'd start right in as soon as we nooned up in the hayfield. I was in on a big cattle gather one fall. All the outfits from Big Porcupine Creek to the mouth of the Marias had their crews out there. And this one by God day, right in there with cows and calves we were shoving down into a kind of a basin, was this hell of a big bull elk right out in the middle of those cattle. Somebody got the idea, I'm not saying it was me, of why don't we rope and brand that elk? Well, you know that was the next thing we did. We had to swing community loops big enough to get over his antlers, of course. But by God, we got him down there. A couple of us ropers even managed to get our lassos on and heel him there. And so we got this big elk down there on the ground. Started bringing in the Brandon irons on him. By Jesus, there were enough outfits there that we just covered that son of a gun from one end to the other with brands. Turned him loose. Well, you know, it was years later, way down in the Highwood Mountains, when somebody finally bagged that elk, could not figure out how in Christ's name the thing got covered with all those brands. See what I mean? The guy was a specimen of mammoth mouth, if there ever was one. For the life of me, I could not see why the rest of the world didn't catch on to his wind jamming. I don't know, though. Even I was only 15 years old, I guess I was the only one on Noon Creek that summer who didn't happen to believe in alphabetical elk.
The far corners, the back pockets of the planet, the edge of the world. But what's going on out there, and I hope out here, is a style of rich, chance-taking fiction. For a generation or so, the U.S. literary fashion has been show, don't tell. Depict your characters and their surroundings while forswearing that old literary demon rhetoric. Thank God, no such advice ever reached Shakespeare. Nor Thomas Keneally in Australia. Nor Nadine Gordimer in South Africa. Nor Trinidad-born V.S. Naipaul, the world-class of writers who have shown us in such vivifying novels as The Playmaker and A Sport of Nature and A Bend in the River that it is possible to write fiction with character as well as characters. While experimental fiction in this country has been nearsightedly eating its own tail, and minimalism has been yawning in condescension toward people who have to shop at the Kmart instead of Banana Republic, show and tell has been occurring in world literature. And guess what? The old grade school dictum is still valid. We can learn fresh wonders from the experience of others. The arrival of this new world class of writers, I think, has significant reverberations for those of us trying to write about the reaches of the American West. For one thing, they provide us the always useful reminder that we are not alone, that others too have faced landscapes dauntingly bigger than themselves, have come to terms with remoteness, have been tempered instead of broken by hard times. For another, it's notable that so many of these strong new outback writers come from former outposts of the British Empire, and their novels are skeptical of governance from afar. of the tendency for those on the geographical fringes to also end up with the thinnest shares of the society's wealth. I'm only able to report to you how one writer, he happens to be the one I know best since I meet him in the mirror each morning, has felt it valuable to be able to look around on the geographical outskirts and see how others have found their creative equilibrium. While I've been spending the 1980s tapping out a fictional trio of books that will give glimpses into my own created world of Montana during its first 100 years of statehood, it's been heartening to me to know of books such as The Book of Ebenezer LePage by G.B. Edwards and Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, which pushed the language out into odd, eloquent corners of the world, the Isle of Guernsey and post-nuclear Holocaust England. So, I look around at this end of the country and beyond and take heart that there's quite a bunch of us out here, out there, writing at our own centers of the universe, and they're not the metropolitan polar centers. That there's a new kind of eloquence being created in fiction, which is not just an eloquence of the West, but an eloquence of the edge of the world. Now to some writing, instead of talking about it. I want to read you a scene from the manuscript of the novel I'm finishing up. By next Labor Day, it'll be in print as an actual book, probably with the title Ride With Me, Mariah Montana. And you need just a bit of background on the three main characters. The narrator is Jick McCaskill, coming on to 15 years old at the time he was the eyewitness rememberer of English Creek. Now Jick is coming on to 65. Mariah is his daughter, 35 years old, photographer for a fictitious Missoula newspaper, out on assignment to do photographic features in commemoration of Montana's centennial. The third character is the star writer for the newspaper, assigned to work with Mariah on the centennial pieces, Riley Wright. And he is also Mariah's ex-husband. These three are traveling Montana in Jick's Winnebago, an arrangement thought up by Mariah to put a kind of combination chaperone and shotgun rider between her and Riley. A couple of other names you'll encounter here, Marcella, Jick's deceased wife, and Lexa, the other McCaskill daughter, Mariah's sister. Also, bits of this are in italics, representing Riley's newspaper story about this incident, and I'll try to remember to signal you when I'm in that italic mode. In this scene, having spent the preceding couple of days at Jick's ranch in the town of Grovan, Jick is driving Mariah and Riley in the motorhome, the Bago, as he calls it, south towards Shoto, along the Rocky Mountain front, to whatever story it is they've arranged to do next. This takes place about 2 months ago. Has this got to do with dinosaur eggs, I hope? In that vicinity, out northwest of Shoto, lay Egg Mountain. No more than a bit of a bump in the prairie, really, but where whole nests laid by dinosaurs had been found. And while I can't claim to know much more about paleontology than how to spell it, any scene where creatures of 80 million years ago hatched out their young like mammoth baby chicks sounded to me highly interesting. Not exactly. Here's your turn coming up, Mariah busily pointed out. That sign, there where it says, Yeah, I can see that far, I said, and gave her a look. What, did she figure I'm getting so decrepit I couldn't read the obvious roadside sign, which directed in perfectly clear lettering, Pine Butte Swamp Preserve, established 1969, administered by the Nature Conservancy, 14 miles. The Teton country here is quite the geography. Gravel roading straight west, as the Bago now was, we had in front of us the rough Great Wall of the Rockies, where gate-like canyons on either side of Indian Head Rock let forth the twin forks of the Teton River. The floor-like plain that leads to the foot of the mountains is wet and spongy in some places, in others bone dry, in still others common prairie. And even though I usually only remark it from a distance when I'm driving past on a Great Falls trip, Pine Butte itself seems like a neighbor to me, so to speak. It and its kindred promontories make a line of landmarks between the mountains and the eastward horizon of plains. Heart Butte, north near the Two Medicine River. Breed Butte, of course, between Noon Creek and English Creek. Pine Butte, presiding here over the Teton country like a surprising pine-topped mesa. Haystack Butte, south near Augusta. Somehow, they remind me of lighthouses, spaced as they are along the edge of that tumult of rock that builds into the Continental Divide. Lone sentinel forms the eyes seek. We drove in sunny silence until I said something about how surprising it was to have a swamp out on a prairie, causing Riley to get learned and inform me that the Pine Butte Swamp actually was underlain with so much bog it qualified as a fen. "That what you're going to do here, some kind of an ecology piece?" I asked. "Sort of," Mariah said. "Sounds real good to me," I endorsed, gantering out at the companionable outline of Pine Butte drawing ever nearer in the boggy bottomland. In Montana, you don't see a fen just every day. And the summits of the Rockies, gray as eternity, meeting the blue August sky. "Great day for the race," I chirped even. Oh, I knew full well Mariah had heard that one a jillion times from me. But I figured maybe Riley would fall for it by asking, "What race?" And then I'd get him by saying, "The human race." But no such luck. Instead, Riley busied up behind me and announced, "Okay, gang, we've got to start watching along the brush for the state outfit. Should be easy enough to see. There's a crane on the truck they used to hoist the..." "I'll watch out this side," Mariah broke in on him and proceeded to peer out her window as if she'd just discovered glass is transparent. Dumb me. Even then, I didn't catch on until another mile or so down the road, when I happened to think out loud that even though we were going to be with ecology guys, we'd all need to watch a little bit out in country like this, because the Pine Butte area is the last prairie habitat of... The stiffening back of that daughter of mine abruptly told it. "Grizzlies?" I concluded in a bleat. "Has this got to do with grizzlies?" "Just one," said Mariah, super earnestly gazing off across the countryside away from my stare. "That's way too goddamn many. This isn't going to be what I'm afraid it is it? Tell me it isn't." Of course, neither of this pair of story-chasing maniacs would tell me any such thing, so the nasty hunch that had been crawling up the back of my neck pounced. "Bear moving!" I slammed on the brakes, and right there in the middle of the county road swung around in my seat, as mad as I was scared, which is saying a lot. To goggle first at Mariah, who ought to have known better than this, and then at Riley, whose goddamn phone call this morning all too clearly led into this. "Jesus H. Christ, you two! Anybody with a lick of sense doesn't want to be within 50 miles of moving a grizzly." "I reckon that's why the job falls to us," Riley couldn't resist rumbling in one of his mock hero voices. "What's got you in an uproar, Jick? The good news is you don't have to chauffeur the bear and the bagel. The state guys load him up in a culvert trap." I didn't give a hoot if they had San Quentin on wheels to load a grizzly in. I wanted no part of it, and I then and there let Mariah and Riley know exactly that. Did they even read their own newspaper, for Christ's sake? Only days ago, a hiking couple in Glacier Park had encountered a sow grizzly and her two cubs, and survived the mauling only because they had the extreme guts and good sense to drop to the ground and play dead. And not all that far from where we right now sat, several grizzlies lately kept getting into the geese and ducks at the Rockport Hutterite colony, till the Hutterites managed to run them off with a big tractor. The bagel, I emphasized, was no tractor. Which did me about as much good with those two as if I'd set it all down a gopher hole. Riley was mostly the one who worked on me. Mariah knew good and well how ticked off I was at her for this. And of course, Argument might as well have been his middle name. The bear is already caught in a cable snare. The state guys will conk him out with a tranquilizer gun. Then they'll haul him in a chunk of culvert made of solid steel he'd have to go nuclear to get out of. Where's the problem? He concluded, seeming genuinely puzzled. The rancher portion of me almost said back to him, "The problem is the grizzly, you Missoula ninny." Instead, in spite of myself, my eyes took over from my tongue. I scrutinized the brush-lined creek as if counting up its willows like a tally with wooden matchsticks. They probed each shadowed dip of the Pine Butte fen. They leapt to every ruffle of breeze in the grass, seeking and seeking the great furry form. All the while, Riley's bewilderment was stacking up against the silent bounds of me and Mariah. "Gang, I don't know what the deal is here, but we can't just sit in the middle of this road watching the seasons change." "Are you two going to this bear, whether or not I'm along?" I managed to ask. Say for Riley that he did have marginally enough sense to let Mariah do the answering on that one. "Yes," she said, still without quite ever looking at me. "The state guys are waiting for us." I jammed the Vago into gear, and we went on down the road for, maybe as much as a quarter of a mile before Riley's bursting curiosity propelled out the remark, "Well, just speaking for myself, this is going to be something to remember, getting a free look at a grizzly, hmm?" When neither of us in the cab of the motorhome responded, he resorted to, "You ever seen one before, Chick?" "Yeah." "But up close?" "Close enough." I glanced over at Mariah. Her face carefully showed nothing, but I knew she was replaying the memory, seeing it all again. Who could not? I went on. "I killed one once." "The hell?" From Riley in his patented, "Well then, tell me all about it" tone. "There on Dune Creek, you mean?" "In the mountains back of the ranch, yeah." As sudden as that, the sight near Flume Gulch was in my mind, as if the earth had jumped a click in its rotation and flung the fire-scarred slope, the survivor pine tree with its claw-torn bark, in through my eyes. Greatly as I wished he would not, Riley naturally persisted with the topic. "You run across him by accident or track him down?" "Neither." "Then how'd you get together with Brother Grizz?" "I baited him." Strong silence from behind me. At last Riley said, "Did you? My dad did some of that too whenever he'd lose a calf. The black bear, those were. We didn't have grizzlies in the Crazy Mountains anymore." Those last two words of his said the whole issue. Originally, the West had been absolutely loaded with grizzly bears, but now they were on the endangered species list. "I'm not one of those 3S guys, if that's what you're thinking," I told Riley stonily. Law on the side of the grizzly notwithstanding, there still were some ranchers along these mountains who practiced the policy of shoot, shovel, and shut up. Better a buried bear would be no threat to livestock or the leasing of oil rights than a living exemplification of wilderness, ran that reasoning. "Riley never said you were," Mariah put in her two bits worth. "Actually, except for her contribution being on his behalf, it was just as well she did ante herself into this discussion, for my ultimate say on the grizzly issue needed to be to her rather than to some scribbler. I spoke it now, slowly and carefully. I don't believe in things going extinct, but that includes me, too." I knew Riley was grinning his sly grin. "A grizzly couldn't have said it any better, Jick," issued from him. I didn't care. I could see that my words had hit home in Mariah, complicating what she had been remembering. What we both were remembering. That time of the grizzly 25 years before. It started with a paw mark in the pan of the slop milk Mariah had given the chickens. Why that pan caught her eye so soon again after she'd done her morning chore of feeding the poultry flock, I do not know. Maybe even at 10 years old, as she was then, Mariah simply was determined to notice everything. When she came down to the lambing shed to find me, I'm surprised she and Lexa hadn't left yet for school, but nowhere near so surprised as when she told me, "You'd better come see the bear track." I dropped to one knee there in the filth of the chicken yard, mindful only of that pale outline in the pan. My own hand was not as steady as I would have liked when I measured the bear's print with it. From the end of the palm-like pad to the tip of the long middle spike of the five claws, my splayed hand just barely spanned. 9-inch paw print. Not just a grizzly, a sizable one. Considerations of all kinds swarmed in behind that paw print. No sheep rancher has any reason to welcome a grizzly that I know of. A grizzly bear and a band of sheep is dynamite. Butchers as many sheep as it can reach. So my mind flew automatically to the bunches of ewes and lambs scattered across the ranch. Late April this was, the tail end of lambing time. Like clusters of targets. But before that thought was fully done, the feel of invasion of our family was filling me. The creature that slurped the chicken's milk and casually tromped through the still damp pan had been here astride the daily paths of our lives. Marcella, merely on her way out to the clothesline. Mariah, simply on her way to the chicken house. Lexa, in any of her scampery after-school roamings. Any of those random goings surely crisscrossed whatever route brought the grizzly, coming out of hibernation, hungry and irritable, into the ranch buildings. Nor was I personally keen to be out on some chore, and afterward all they'd ever find of me would be my belt buckle and a grizzly turd. So when I phoned the government trapper, and his wife said he was down at the other end of the county for the rest of the week, I did not feel I could wait. It was the work of all that day to pick and prepare the trap site. Up toward Flume Gulch, I was able to find the grizzly's tracks in the mud of the creek crossing, and on the trail along the old burn area of the 1939 forest fire, I came across what in all likelihood was the same bear's dropping, a black pile you'd step into the top of your ankle. I chose the stoutest survivor pine there at the edge of the old burn, and used the winch of the power wagon to snake a long, heavy bullpine log in beside the base of the tree. Around the tree, I built a rough pen of smaller logs to keep any stray livestock from blundering in. Even though the other blundersome species wasn't likely to come sashaying past, I nonetheless nailed up a sign painted in red sheep paint to tell people, "Look out, bear trap here." Then I bolted the chain of the trap to the bullpine log and set the trap, those enormous steel jaws wickedly open in the middle of the pen, and covered it with pine swags. Finally, from the tree limb directly over the trap, I hung the bait. A can of bacon grease. One thing I had not calculated on. The next day was Saturday, and I got up that morning to two schoolless daughters who overnight had caught the feverish delusion that they were going with me to check the bear trap. They took my no to the court of appeal, but even after their mother had upped the verdict to, "You are not going, let's not hear one more word about it," their little hearts continued to break loudly. All through breakfast, there were outbreaks of 8-year-old pouts from Lexa, 10-year-old disputations from Mariah, as the "aws" and "why can't we's" poured forth. I was more amused than anything else until the older of these caterwauling daughters cut out her commotion and said in a sudden new voice, "You'd take us if we were boys." Mariah should have grown up to be a neurosurgeon. She always could find a nerve. Right then, I wanted to swat her precocious butt until she took that back. Simultaneously, I knew she had spoken a major truth. "Mariah, that will do," crackled instantly from her mother. But by Marcella's frozen position across the table from me, I knew our daughter's words had hit her as they had me. Mariah still was meeting our parental storm and giving as good as she got, at risk but unafraid. Beside the tense triangle of the other three of us, Lex's mouth made an exquisite little "oh" in awe of her sister who scolded grown-ups. That next minute of Marcella and I convening our eyes, voting to each other on Mariah's accusation, I can still feel the pierce of. At last, I said to my fellow defendant, I could stand some company up there. How would you feel about all four of us going? It's beginning to look like we'd better, Marcella agreed. But you too, she gave Lexa a warning look and doubled it for Mariah. You two are staying in the power wagon with me, understand? When we got up to Flume Gulch, we had a bear waiting. Its fur was a surprisingly light tan. Plenty of it loomed above the trap pen. This grizzly more than lived up to the size of his tracks. The impression the caught animal gave, which shocked me at first, was that it was pacing back and forth in the trap pen, peering over the stacked logs as if watching for our arrival. Then I realized that the bear was so angrily restless it only seemed he was moving freely. In actuality, he was anchored to the bull pine log by the chain of the trap and could only maneuver as if on a short tether. I will tell you, though, that it dried my mouth a little to see how mobile a grizzly was, even with a hind leg and a steel trap biting to its bone. We must have made quite a family tableau framed in the windshield of the power wagon. Lexa, so little she only showed from the eyes up as she craned to see over the dashboard. Mariah, as intent as an astronomer in a new galaxy. Their mother and I, bolt upright on either side, trying not to look as agog as our daughters. I better get at it, I said as much to myself as to Marcella. Something bothered me about how rambunctious the bear was managing to be in the trap. Not that I was any expert on grizzly deportment, nor wanted to be. Quickly, I climbed out of the power wagon and reached behind the seat for the rifle while Marcella replaced me behind the wheel and kept watch on the grizzly. Mariah craned her neck and cataloged my every move as I loaded shells into the magazine of the gun and dropped an extra handful in my shirt pocket. "Daddy will show that bear," Lexa piped fearlessly. Daddy hoped she was a wise child. Armed and on the ground, I felt somewhat less spooked about the chore of disposing of the bear. Habits of hunting took over, and as if I was skirting up the ridge to stay above a herd of deer below, before no time I had worked my way upslope from the trap tree and the bear to where my shot would be at a safe angle away from the spectating trio in the power wagon, all the while watching the tan form of trapped anger, doubtless being watched by it. I drew in a breath and jacked a shell into the chamber of the 30-06. All in a day's work, if this was the kind of work you were in, I kept telling myself. Aim, fire, bingo, Bruin goes to a honey cloud. Hell, other ranchers who had grazing allotments farther up in the Two Medicine National Forest, where there was almost regular traffic at grizzlies, probably had shot dozens of them over the years. Abruptly and powerfully, the bear surged upright and lurched toward the standing pine tree, as if to shelter behind it from me and my rifle. The chain on the trap was only long enough for the bear to get to the tree, not around it. But as the animal strained there, I saw that only its toes of the left rear foot were clamped in the jaws of the trap, not the rear leg itself, which awfully suddenly explained why the bear seemed so maneuverable in the trap pen. Next thing to not caught, the trapper Isidore Pronovo used to say of a weasel or a bobcat, toe-trapped that way. Barely held, but unable to escape. Such chanciness seemed all the mightier when the caught creature was as huge as this grizzly. I will swear on all the Bibles there are, I was not intentionally delaying the bear's execution. Rather, I was settling the barrel of the 30-06 across a silvered stump for a businesslike heart shot, when, instead, the grizzly abruptly began climbing the tree, attacking up the tree, erupting up the tree, whatever way it can strongest be said. But branches as thick as my arm were cracking off and flying. Dangling bait cans sailed off and clanked against the snag not 5 feet from me. The fantastic claws were raking furrows into the wood. The furry hulk of body was launching itself into that tree. The trap dangling from the bear's rear toes was coursing upward too, tautening the chain fastened into the bullpine log. Offal turned even worse now. The log lifted at its chained end and began to be dragged to the tree, the bear bellowing out its pain and rage at the strain of that taut pull, yet still mauling its way up the trunk of the tree. I stood stunned at the excruciating tug of war, the arithmetic of hell that was happening, for the log's dead weight on those toes could... Then I realized the grizzly was trying to tear its toes off to get free. All prescribed notions of a sure heart shot flew out of me. I fired at the bear simply to hit it, then blazed away again, again, as it slumped and began sliding down the tree trunk, claws slashing bark off as they dragged downward, the rifle in my arm speaking again, 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 the last two shots into the animal's neck as it crumpled inside the trap pen. All those years after, I could understand that Mariah was uneasy about that memory of the toe-caught but doomed grizzly. What the hell? I was not anywhere near easy about it myself, even though I yet believed with everything in me that that particular bear had to be gotten rid of. I mean, paw prints when you go out to feed the chickens. But I knew that what was bugging Mariah was not just the fate that bear had wandered into on our ranch. No, her bothersome remembering was of us, the McCaskills as we were on that morning, of the excitement that danced in all four of us after I had done the shooting. Marcella with her world-beating grin, Lexa hopping up and down as she put out her small hand to touch the pale fur, Mariah stock still but fever-eyed with the thrill of what she'd witnessed. Myself, breaking into a wild smile of having survived. Of our family pride, for in honesty it can be called no less, about the killing of the grizzly, with never a thought that its carcass was any kind of a lasting nick out of nature. Late now, though, to try to tack so sizable an afterthought into that Flume Gulch morning. Clearly, this day's grizzly at Pine Butte already knew that matters had become more complicated. The snared bear lay quiet but watchful under a big cottonwood, a respectful distance between it and the two state men beside their truck. With the motor home, the three of us entered the picture. Riley knew the biologist from wildlife headquarters in Helena through once having written something about him, and the biologist in turn acquainted us with his helper in bear moving, big, calm sort, who apparently had been hired for both his muscle power and disposition. After we'd all handshook and murmured our hellos, the immediate next sound was Mariah's camera catching the stare of the bear. Inevitably, she asked, "How close can I go?" "Right where you are is close enough till we get him tranked," the biologist advised. I could believe it. My God, even the fur on the thing looked dangerous. This bear was browner than the cinnamon one I'd shot, and the wind rippled in that restless dark field of hair. "What have we got here?" Riley was the asker now. I sent him a look. "We?" "A JD, probably about a two-year-old," the biologist answered, and went on to explain that a young bear like this one was really a lot like a juvenile delinquent. No slot in life yet, getting into trouble while it poked around. More than probably, it had been one of the assailants on the Hutterites' fowl. Mischief this time was spelled V-E-A-L, a white-faced calf killed in the fence corner of the rancher's pasture we were now in. Italics from Riley. This contest, too, is tribal. Ignore the incidental details that one community is four-footed and furred, and the other consists of scantily haired bipeds. And see the question as two tribes in what is no longer enough space for two. Dominion, oldest of quarrels. The grizzly brings to the issue its formidable natural aptitude, imperial talent to live on anything from ants to, as it happens, livestock. But the furless tribe possesses the evolutionary equivalent of a nuclear event, the outsized brain that enables them to fashion weapons that strike beyond the reach of their own bodies. Jick again. Somehow the bear's single pair of eyes watched us with greater total intensity than our five human pair could manage in watching him. And a grizzly's eyes are not nearly its best equipment either. Into that black beezer of a nose and those powerful ears, our smells and sounds must have been like stench and thunder to the animal. The majority of my own staring went to the rounded crown of fur atop the bear's front quarters, the trademark hump of the grizzly. Not huge, just kind of like an extra bicep up there. An overhead motor of muscle that enabled the grizzly to run 30 miles an hour or to break a smaller animal's neck with one swipe or to rip off its own trapped toe. My throat was oddly dry when the question came out of me. What do you bait with? The biologist turned his head enough to study me, then sent Riley an inquiring look. Who, goddamn his knack for aggravation, gave a generous okaying nod. Just what my mood needed, a Riley Wright seal of approval. Roadkills, the biologist told me. I collect them. Heck of a hobby, isn't it? Let them get good and rotten. I believe this particular bait is prime grade A squashed badger. Now the bear movers went to work on their respective armaments, the helper loading both barrels of a 12-gauge shotgun with slugs, while a biologist, with doctor gloves on, used a syringe to put the tranquilizer dose into a metal dart, then inserted the dart into what looked almost like a .22 rifle. This is always a fun part, the biologist said glumly to us, and edged out slowly toward the grizzly with the shotgunner beside him. Clicking and more clicking issued from Mariah's camera. Riley alternately jotted in his notebook and restlessly tapped his pen on it. I wonder now how I was able to hear anything over the beating of my heart. The biologist raised his dart rifle, leveled it for what seemed like a long time, then fired a compressed air phoop. The dart hit the grizzly high in the hind quarters. The pair of state men rapidly walked backwards to where we were. The bear reared up behind, thrashed briefly, then became a kind of breathing statue as the paralyzing drug gripped it. The bear movers stood and waited, the shotgunner never taking his eyes off the bear, the biologist steadily checking his watch. After 5 minutes, the biologist said, "Let's try him." He reached in the back of the truck for a long-handled shovel. Going over beside the hairy bulk with a careful but steady stride while the helper trailed him, shotgun at the ready, the biologist took a stance and rapped the bear on the near shoulder with the end of the shovel handle. Not real hard, but probably plenty to start a fight if the other party is a grizzly. When the bear just lay there and took that, the biologist announced, "Okay, he's under." Christ almighty, I hadn't known there was even going to be any question about it. Or I for sure would have watched this part of the procedure from inside the metal walls of the motorhome. There was a surprising amount of business to be done to the tranked bear, weighing it in a tarp sling and scale that the state pair rigged from the stoutest branch overhead, checking its breathing rate every few minutes, fastening a radio collar on, surveillance to see whether this was going to be a repeat offender, putting salve into its eyes to blear its vision as a safety measure for when it would be released. And, of course, as the biologist said, the really fun part, loading the thing into the culvert cage. All of us got involved in that except Mariah. For once I was thankful for her camera mania as she dipped and dove around, snapping away at the two state guys and Riley and me huffing and puffing to insert the 300-pound heap of limp grizzly into the tank-like silver container. Every instant of that, remembering the fury exploding up that tree of 25 years ago, claws slashing bark into ribbons and broken branches flying, I was devoutly hoping this bear was going to stay tranquil. Sure, you bet, no question, but it was snoozing as thoroughly as drug science could make it do. Yet, this creature in our hands felt hot-blooded and ungodly strong. Its eyes still were open. Heaven's front gate could never sound more welcome than that clang of the grate dropping closed when we at last had the bear bedded inside the steel culvert section. "Nothing much to this job, hmm?" the panting Riley remarked to the biologist. The state men then employed their crane to lift the cage onto the truck and soundly secured it. "Well, there," I declared, glad to be done with this bear business. Almost as one, Mariah and Riley looked at me as if I was getting up from supper just as the meat and potatoes were put on the table. Good God! How literal could they get, even if they were newspaper people? I mean, the bear movers had the bear all but underway. Did we need to watch every revolution of the truck's wheels, tag along like the welcome wagon to the grizzly's new home, to be able to say we'd seen bear moving? By Mariah and Riley's lights, indubitably. Out our bear caravan proceeded to Highway 89, and then south and west down thinner and thinner roads to a distant edge of the Bob Marshall wilderness. As we went and went, perhaps the bear was keeping his bearings, but I sure as hell couldn't have automatically found my way back to the Pine Butte country. Italics from Riley. Exile is the loser's land. Others set its borders, state its terms, enforce the diminishment as only the victors know how. The outcast sniffs the cell of wilderness. Jick again. The motorhome had been growling in low gear for what seemed hours, up and up a mountain road which had never heard of a bagel before, until at last the truck ahead swung into a sizable clearing. "Here's where we tell our passenger adios," the biologist came over to us to confirm that this at last was the release site, sounding several 100% more cheerful than he had all day. The idea now, he told Riley and Mariah, was to simply let the bear out of the cage, watch it a little while to be sure the tranquilizer was wearing off okay, and allow it to go its wild wood way, up here far from tempting morsels of calf, etc. He could not have been any readier than I was to say goodbye to the grizzly. The back of my neck was prickling, and though I couldn't see into the culvert cage, I somehow utterly knew. Maybe the memory of the bear I had killed, superimposing itself here, that the ruff of hair on the young grizzly's hump was standing on end, too. "You folks stay in," the biologist added, somewhat needlessly, I thought, before heading back to the truck. The state pair themselves were going to be within for this finale of bear moving, for they could operate the crane and the cage door and the whole shebang from inside the cab of the truck. Except for rolling her window down farther than I liked, even Mariah showed no great desire to be out there to greet the bear, and instead she uncapped a long lens and fitted it onto her camera. The remote control debarkation of the bear began, the crane hoisting the cage up from the bed of the truck, pivoting, then letting the cage to the ground. All that remained was to work the apparatus that would lift the gate of the culvert cage, and the bear could vamoose. We waited and waited. It was Mariah, scoping over there with her lens, who said it aloud. "Something's fouled up." The truck doors opened, and the two bear movers stepped out, the helper carefully carrying the shotgun. Reluctantly, but I suppose necessarily, I rolled my window down and craned my head out, Riley leaning close behind me. "Equipment!" the biologist bitterly called over to us as if it was his personal malady. "It won't be as pretty, but we can do it by hand." With the truck doors open for their retreat, the pair of men advanced slowly to the culvert cage. The biologist worked over the pulley cable that would lift the cage gate. Then he established himself behind the cage, out of the bear's line of sight, with the shotgun guard right beside him, and reeled in the cable by hand. The gate lifted in good order, and the biologist bent to secure the pulley cable. From the cage, there was the sound of great weight shifting as the grizzly adjusted to the fact of freedom out there beyond the mouth of daylight. The big, broad head poked into sight, then the shoulders with the furred hump atop them. In the opposite direction, the men, backing away soundlessly, were nearly back to the cab of the truck. I breathed with relief that we were about to be through with that haunting passenger. The grizzly was all but out of the cage when something snapped, and the heavy gate slammed down on its tailbone. Whirling against what it took to be attack, the grizzly rushed past the cage, snarling, searching. The men had been stopped short of the truck by the noise of the crashing gate. They froze now, not to give the bear any motion he could distinguish through the blaring salve. Just as suddenly as it had whirled and charged, the bear stopped and reared up on its hind legs, turning its head from side to side, as if trying to judge the suspicious outlines between it and the truck. Then the grizzly came at the men. "Don't, bear!" the biologist cried out. "Boom!" the shotgun blasted. And within the ringing in my ears, I could hear the deep peal of the echo diminish out over the mountainside. Riley's italics. Both shotgun slugs hit the grizzly in the chest simultaneously. Stopping power, the human tribe called such large-caliber ballistics. And it stopped the life of the bear the instant the twin bolt of lead tore into his heart and lungs. The bear slumped sideways, crumpled, and lay there in the clearing. Above the sudden carcass, the two bear movers stood rooted for a long moment. For one, or maybe both of them, the shotgun... Chick's words again. Of all of Mariah's pictures of that day, here was the one that joined into Riley's words. Riley's italics. But as the shotgunner still held the gun pointing toward the grizzly, these survivors, too, seemed as lifeless as the furred victims.